right. This morning, we're in part two of our series, Amazing Stories. And today, I thought the way we would start off is I would share with you a truly amazing story. This is a story that probably a year, year and a half ago, I was reading a book. And in the very first chapters, I started reading it. I found myself just absolutely captivated and just drawn into this story. And I thought, wow, this is one I can't wait to share. So today is that day. I'm going to share this story with you. And to share it with you, I need to take you back in time from this very month to 8 years ago, to May of 2004, to the beautiful state of California. And in the state of California in May of 2004, there's this one character, this one guy, this is a true story, by the name of Butch Connor. And Butch was a 44-year-old dude. He was just married, had kids. He was living his life, working his job, paying bills, paying taxes like I hope all of us are doing. He was just doing his thing. But Butch Connor also had something he enjoyed. Is on the side, he had a hobby. It was something he liked to do from time to time, and it was surf. Well, one particular day, on seemingly a beautiful day there in California, he had heard that the water and the waves were ideal. All the conditions were ideal for surfing. And so Butch was not going to let a good surfing day pass him by, so he drove home, he grabbed his wetsuit, he put it on, he jumped in his car with a surfboard, and he drove to Salmon Creek Beach, which is a little north of San Francisco in Northern California. And as he arrived at the beach, he drove up, found a parking spot. He found that the water was ideal. So he walked down to the beach, he entered into the water, and he found that he was not the only one that had gotten wind of the perfect surfing conditions, because there were a lot of surfers in the water that day. And so he went out there in the midst of all these surfers, and they were surfing and catching waves and just having a good time. But finally, Butch said, I kind of want to do my own thing. And so he decided he was going to paddle off about 40 yards, which is about a little less than half of a football field in length, away from the other surfers, and he was going to just surf by himself. And so he paddled off, and as he went over to this area, and he found himself in the perfect spot, seemingly, he turned his back to the waves, and he waited, seated on his surfboard. Well, as he looked over his shoulder, he finally found the perfect wave for me. It was going to crest perfectly. It was at the right time for him. And so he immediately laid down on his board, and he started paddling because he was going to catch this perfect wave. Well, as he was paddling, immediately he heard a splash behind him. And it was not a small splash. It was a pretty large splash. And he turned and looked over his shoulder, and he saw a very large dorsal fin protruding from the top of the water about 4 feet from him and moving directly toward him pretty fast. And one thing that Butch recognized and knew that quick was this was not an ordinary fish. This was not a very nice fish that you read about to your children in comic books or in just little kids' books, right? This was a fish that was swimming like this, not like this. And immediately what he knew was behind him was a great white shark. And just in case you've forgotten what Jaws looks like, I'll put a picture on the screen for you, and we'll leave it there just for the moment, okay? Throughout this story, is that behind him was a great white shark, and they estimated that this shark was between 14 to 18 feet long from nose to tail, around 3,000 pounds of man-eating machine right behind him, 4 feet away, moving directly toward him. Well, once Butch saw this, once it registered in his mind what happened or what was taking place, he immediately shut down. He was absolutely captured by fear and by terror. He couldn't breathe, he couldn't move, he couldn't do anything. So he just lay on his board. And the wave went under Butch and went past Butch, and he lay there. And here's what happened next. This massive shark began circling Butch one time, two times, three times, and then the fourth time. And after the fourth time of circling Butch, this shark begins moving directly towards Butch. He's just frozen, you know, scared to death, laying on his board, his left leg dangling a little off the side of his board. And this shark begins opening its mouth and comes up to eat Butch, or at least his leg. And he goes up, and as he goes to clamp down, somehow or another, Butch's leg stays on the nose of the shark all the way up and all the way down, and the shark never even bit him. Well, when the shark came down out of the back into the water, he started thrashing about hysterically. Butch falls off of his board. He's in the water now himself, this 3,000-pound man-eating machine and his surfboard. And Butch says immediately, the fear, the terror fled away. And it was replaced by another emotion. It was anger. He said he was hacked off. Because he was thinking, I was laying there as bait for you one time. Now I'm not going to do that. I'm going to fight you. And then the shark moves away from Butch and begins the four circles again. But this time, Butch did something different. He stayed in the water. He held his surfboard. And as the shark turned, he turned. And he kept the point of his board right between him and the shark. After the fourth turn, the shark immediately starts moving towards Butch again, comes out of the water, about to attack him. He takes his surfboard and he jams it into the gills of this big, great white shark. And immediately the shark goes ballistic. It may have hurt him or may have made it mad. And immediately as the shark starts thrashing, Butch screams out, "Shark, shark," and all the other surfers that were 40 yards away notice what's taking place. All this water being displaced, this massive fish, this little dude in the water, and they start running on water to get out of the ocean, right? And then Butch immediately throws himself on his board, starts paddling as hard and as fast as he can to try to get to shore about 100 yards away, and then sadly, the shark ends up between him and the shore again. And Butch said that when that happened, he immediately said, "That's it." He froze in terror again, scared to death, couldn't breathe, couldn't move. But as he was laying there on his board, within probably a fraction of seconds, he had another thought come in his mind, and it was, "What about my family? Can they live without me?" And as soon as that thought captured his mind, all of his power, all of his energy moved back through his body, and he started paddling again. He said, "Forget it, I'm going for it." And so the shark was probably confused, right? It was used to doing the little four circle thing, and he shoots off, right? And so he starts pursuing and moving towards the beach. I'm sure all the different surfers and spectators on the beach were yelling for him to go. And as he started moving towards the beach, he gets caught in a riptide. Now, if you don't know what a riptide is, that's the opposite direction Butch needed to go. The water was going out towards the shark, not back away from the shark, and he gets caught in the riptide. And for 5 minutes, Butch fights and fights and fights against the rip current. And after 5 minutes, he walks on the beach without a scratch. Against all odds of this massive great white shark, attacking him twice, circling him three times, chasing him, this guy comes out of the water without a scratch on him. It's truly an amazing story. Now, as I share that story with you, and as you're listening, I can see your eyes and faces a little bit. What I could tell was taking place were a couple of things. One is you started feeling emotions as you saw this picture and heard the story, didn't you? Some of you were feeling the emotions of anger, hearing about this mean shark attacking this poor guy out surfing. Some of you felt the emotions of fear and terror, like you were identifying with Butch, that you were in the water, and what it would have been like for you to look over your shoulder and see this massive shark coming at you. Some of you maybe felt even the emotions of sadness when that third time he was cornered again. But then also, not only were you feeling emotions, you were thinking something. Many of you were thinking about what you would have done had you been in his situation, weren't you? Many of you were thinking, after that first time of getting knocked off the board, even if you would not have been eaten or bitten, you would have just laid there. He'd had an easy lunch, right? You would have been frozen stiff in fear. Others of you were thinking, "No, I'd have kicked it, I'd have cussed it, I would have screamed, I'd have, you know, whatever, to keep from having my life taken." But you know one thing we all did or did not do? Is we didn't have to take action. We could feel it, sense emotions around the story. We could think about it, but thankfully, we didn't have to do anything. Why? Because it's not our story. It's Butch's story. And because it's Butch's story, we can listen, we can feel, we can think, but we don't have to act. And you know, Eddie last week, when he introduced his series to us, he shared with you that each and every one of us are writing a story. Our lives. That on planet Earth today, there are over 6 billion stories being written. New stories with in the beginning, with new life, and even some that are saying the end, with those that are moving on into eternity. But every day, as the world turns, our lives, we are writing our stories. And as our stories are being written throughout our lives, and our weeks and our days, our stories connect and intersect with other stories around us. They intersect as we have today with stories, your story and my story intersecting and others that are seated around you. Your stories intersect with people at work. Your stories intersect with people in your neighborhood, people in your family, people where you go and play, where you go to school. Our stories intersect with each other's stories. And in your story may look something like this. You're a mom, you're a wife, you're a student, you're a husband, you're a father, you're a single adult, and you're going to school, or you're raising a family, or you're working a career, or you're just all these things, your stress, your drama, your issues. And then I have my story, that I'm the husband to Melissa, I have 4 3/4 babies right now, right? And I'm a pastor, a guy that's still trying to figure out what in the world he's doing. I mean, we have our stories. And as our stories intersect with one another, and as we kind of bump up against each other, over time what happens is that you hear and I hear of needs that are present in the stories of other people's lives. That as your story intersects someone at work, or as your story intersects someone at church or at school or wherever, is that you hear that they have a need. It may be a need with their health. It may be a financial need. It may be a need with their marriage, with their family, with their financial situations. It could go on and on and on. That as we intersect life together in this life, we hear of needs. And oftentimes what I've seen in my life that happens is that as I intersect with you and I intersect with other people and I hear about your needs, is that I start feeling for you like we did in the story with Butch. Is I feel compassion when you're hurting. I feel anger sometimes when you're being mistreated. I feel frustrated for you. And you likely do the same as well. But I not only feel, I think for you. I think about what I would do or maybe what you should do. But oftentimes, guys, what I've seen in my life, and probably what you're seeing in your life, is that it's very easy to feel when it's other people's stories. It's very easy to think. But boy, sometimes it's very, very difficult to help or to act. Isn't that true? How often does that happen in your life? You feel for someone. You think about what's going on in their life. But you don't do a darn thing about it. You know why we don't? It's because just like in the story with Butch, that's their story. I have my story. We're so consumed, we're so focused on writing our story and what we have going on and all the things we've got to do that we will feel, we'll think about it, but we don't want to get involved. Now, guys, I want to just be vulnerable with you this morning as your pastor and as your friend and tell you that here lately, God has absolutely been convicting me over how weak I am in this area. That I very, very often, and this is pretty sad for a pastor to admit, isn't it? Let's just go ahead and, yeah. But what God's been showing me is that I'm really weak in this. I've got my story, guys. I've got my family. I've got my thing. I've got how I flow. I have what I'm doing. It's very easy for me to say, that's your story and this is mine. And here's how God's been showing me how weak and why I know how weak I am in this. As my children are now getting to the age to where they understand a little bit about what's going on. Now, probably they've understood a lot of what's going on before now. I just didn't know it, okay? They're the ones that are smart, not me. But there have been occasions where I've been with my children driving around in the city, watching things on TV, documentaries, other things like that, where I see someone in need. They see someone in need. We hear about someone having problems. It could be financial problems. It could be someone that doesn't have a place to live, someone that needs food, someone that needs water, orphans, other situations. And my children will look at me in every situation as they're registering this information, as they're trying to take it in. They'll look at me with the most pure eyes, and they'll look at me and they'll ask me one question. Dad, why? Why are they hungry? Why are they thirsty? Why do they not have a mom and a dad? Why are they getting divorced? Why are they, and just a host of things. And as I look at my children, I find myself fumbling around a lot of times because I'm a dad, but I don't know what I'm doing at that either much. And I look at them and I'm trying to find an answer that they can understand and trying to keep it as clean as I can without, you know, throwing people under the bus or trying to figure it out myself. And I'll give them an answer. And here's what they always do without fail. They'll say, well, let's give them something to eat. Well, let's help provide a place for them to stay. Well, let's help them get a mom or a dad. Let's help them. And it's that quick for them. And it's absolutely convicting. Don't you hate that when your kids do that to you? You feel like you're that big. And they do that. And you know, as I've taken that in, as I continue to take that in for my children, I've come to realize that there are similarities between myself and my kids, but there's also one main difference. Is that when we engage and see and intersect with other people's stories on TV or even up close, my kids feel compassion, anger, frustration. I feel compassion, anger, and frustration. But the massive difference is how they think versus the way I think a lot of times. They have one filter, and the filter is this. What's right is right, and what's wrong is wrong. When they see someone that's hungry, it's like, that's not right. They need food. feed them. They're going through life without a mom or a dad. That's not best. Give them a mom and a dad. Then for them, it's very clean, very simple. But you know, for me, the filter that it runs through in my mind and my heart, these emotions, is primarily this. What will it cost me? Can you identify? What will it cost me? How would it cost me in my time, in my story? How will it cost me with my money? How will it cost me with my heart? How will it cost me? Because for me to get involved in someone else's story means that I have to take away from my story. But see, for my kids, it's a totally different question. It's right and wrong. It's simple. What will it cost me is my question. For them is, what's the right thing to do? And just yesterday, I promise you, this absolutely happened yesterday. It's crazy the timing of it. Just yesterday, I was in my office with my five-year-old son, Drew. And Drew is very bashful. He's a great kid. And we were having God time. That's what we call it. So I asked him a couple open-ended questions. I said, hey, tell me what Jesus means to you. And here's how Drew said it. He said, he wants to be my best friend forever. Now, if you're not in Wamba Land, you don't know. That's what they're teaching him. He wants to be my friend forever, right? Immediately, that quick. And he gives me that cute smile he has. And I said, well, what else, son? And he said, Jesus gives me everything that I need so that I can turn around and give others who have need what they need. That quick. A five-year-old says, Jesus gives me what I need so that I can give to everyone else what they need. But see, I don't think that way, do you? What I tend to think is, Jesus gives me everything that I need for me. Very different. So here's the question. How do we end up here? Because seemingly, at least as children, we don't really think that way. I know we do about our toys and stuff like that, but when it comes to things of monetary value, money and time and, you know, all those things, we don't think that way, but we end up here. And the question is, how do we end up here? Well, I want to take a stab. I want to share with you how I think we got here. Is that as we grow up in our country, a country full of blessing, a country full of liberties, a country full of so many opportunities, that as we move through adolescence, there's one thing we know, and psychologists say this is true, we all know this is true, is ultimately we begin a search for security, for purpose, and for meaning, don't we? You look for security, you look for purpose, and you look for meaning. And in America, from childhood on, our culture basically tells us this, is that security, purpose, and meaning ultimately comes from fulfilling and experiencing the American dream. The American dream family, the American dream marriage, the American dream home, the American dream career, American dream retirement, the American dream vacations, on and on and on. There's this culture of ours tells us it's all about you and myself within our stories pursuing the American dream and fulfilling it and experience it. And then you'll be secure, you'll have meaning, you'll have purpose. And so as a result of that, as we work through this as individuals, writing my story, writing your stories, when we intersect the stories of each other and we see needs, we automatically feel, what will this cost me? Because ultimately we believe our security is found in the American dream and getting there and writing it within our story. Because we always ask, what will it cost me? Well, let me share with you this morning. It's costing us. It is absolutely costing us in our country. As human beings in America, there are some things we are getting right, without a doubt. We are in many ways generous. We are in many ways very, very good. But we also, in this time that we're in as a nation, we are the wealthiest nation ever in the history of the world. There's more influence and affluence in America than anywhere in the world ever. And we as individuals, by writing our own stories and pursuing the American dream for security, fulfillment, and purpose, ultimately become very narcissistic in many ways. Very selfish. And as followers of Jesus, Jesus told us, he said, hey, you are to love one another just as I have loved you. That means that when you intersect the stories of each other, that you are to want to love one another sacrificially. That means give up. Let things cost you. Take things from you to help the lives of others. But today, many of us in our neighborhoods, we come in our garages, drive up in our garages, we shut the door, we go in our backyards with our fences, and we don't even get to know folks or get involved. In churches, we smile, we act like we love each other, and everything's happy-go-lucky, right? But we do not want anything to cost us, so we don't intersect stories where people are needing things and hurting. But not only does it cost us, in practical relationships, guys, it also costs us spiritually. This past week, I was reading a book by Dallas Willard. And Dallas Willard leads the psychology department at the University of Southern California. He's also a Christian, a writer, a pastor, and a theologian. He's brilliant. If you want to read a good book, read a Dallas Willard book. But Dallas Willard had this to say about how all of us as individuals were being messed up, if you will, spiritually with God. And here's what he said. He said, two things block or hinder a life constantly that is interactive with God. There are two things that stand in your way. Here's one. The approval of others. And here's two. The desire to secure ourselves through material wealth. Dallas Willard says this, is that, guys, listen, pursuing the American dream for your security is costing you big time with God. Because that becomes your security, is what you can get, what you can have, and not resting in God. Now this morning, here's what I want to tell you. What I just described, if you feel in any way guilty, convicted, angry at me, whatever, that's good, okay? Because it's normal. What we battle is normal. But here's what's so awesome about God, is that God takes broken, normal people, and he wants to take the lies of the American dream, if you will, of seeking that for security, and the lie of the question that we filter our lives through, where we ask, hey, what is it going to cost me? And he wants to take people like all of us. He wants to change the way we think and establish what is truth and then replace that question with the right question. And this morning, I want to share with you what is true to replace the lie of pursuing security in the American dream. And secondly, what is the question we need to begin filtering our life and our circumstances through other than what will it cost me? And to do this, I'm going to share with you a truly amazing story. There's a story in Scripture written thousands of years ago. And ladies, you're going to love this. It's about a woman. Isn't that awesome? Because at church, you guys hear every week about dudes, don't you? And on Mother's Day, we're going to talk about a woman. This is awesome. And this is a big deal historically, even within Judaism, because ladies back then, you really weren't looked that highly upon. So for the Jewish people to write a story about your life, that's a big deal. Well, it's in the Bible. And this lady, I'll tell you how important she was. These Jewish people, even today, celebrate her story. They read it in the spring each year. They have a festival as a result of her life because of something she first got wrong, but then got right, preserved the entire Jewish race. And this lady's name is Esther. You may have heard of Esther. And Esther, where we're going to jump into the story today, we can't read all 9 chapters. That'd take us a little while. But we're going to jump in the middle of Esther in the 4th chapter. But let me tell you what's taken place up to this point. Esther was a Jewish girl that was orphaned when she was young. Her older cousin Mordecai took care of her. She was raised outside of Israel because of them being in captivity in Persia. Well, through a series of events, Esther becomes the queen of Persia. Pretty cool deal, right? And Esther has this life. Her cousin, as a result of this, Mordecai has a great position. But on one particular day, Esther was probably being pampered, just like all of you were this morning, right, ladies? Breakfast in bed and, you know, being fed grapes and all that good stuff. She was being pampered by all of her ladies that tended to her and all the different, you know, servants and others. And she received word. This was just out of the blue. That her cousin, Mordecai, was out right by the king's gate outside the palace and was wailing. He was dressed in sackcloth and ashes. He was sitting down, plopped down, just yelling and crying and just all messed up. And so, of course, Esther gets up. She's upset. She sends her servants down to him, takes him some clothing and says, hey, here, clothe yourself. What's wrong and all this? And he refuses to take her the clothing. He just sits there and keeps screaming, crying. So Esther finally takes one of her servants, sends him back by the name of Hathach, and says, go to him and find out what's wrong. And here's ultimately what her cousin Mordecai said, is that your husband, Xerxes, the king of Persia, was basically led to write a law, a decree, by Haman, that would, within a year, allow every Jewish person in Persia to be slaughtered. And everything they have to be taken. This is what happened. This is why Mordecai was out there crying, because he was a Jew. And he sends this to her. And look with me in Esther chapter 4. We're going to pick up in verse 8. Watch what happens. It says, we'll catch the end of the story here. So Mordecai also gave him, Hathach, a copy of the written decree as proof to take it up to Esther that was issued in Susa, which is the capital of Persia, for their destruction, for the Jewish people's destruction, so that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her. And then he commanded her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. So in essence, Mordecai says, here, take this to her, show her what's going down for her people, all the Jewish people, myself and others, and say, please go beg the king to not let this happen. Okay, this is the scenario. This is the story. Look with me in verse 9. And so Hathach, this servant, went and he told Esther what Mordecai had said, gave her the decree, the whole thing. And watch what Esther said. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know one thing, that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to, and y'all say the word with me, death. Just for emphasis, like the great white shark picture, death, okay? To be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, Esther says, but as for me, here's what you need to know. I have not been called to come into the king for these 30 days. Esther responds to Hathach after hearing about the situation. She feels for the people, no doubt. She thinks about what could or should be done. But immediately, when she's writing her own story, she looks at her situation. She's in the palace. She's the queen of the king. And she says, hey, here's what you need to know. One law. The king back then was treated like a god. He would be seated on his throne in the inner court. There was an outer court. And whenever someone would approach, if that king did not want for that person to come, if he's having a bad day, bad mood, didn't matter, if he did not tip the golden scepter, they would immediately kill them. They'd hang them. And what Esther said was this, that's the law. And even for me as a queen, this applies. And so Esther said, and here's what you need to know. I haven't even spoken to him in a month. Now, can you imagine not speaking to your husband in a month or your wife? She's saying, and this is how it was in their culture. She said, he may not even be happy with me. This is risking my life. And ultimately what Esther sent back to him was this, it's too risky. I'm not going to do it. Look with me in verse 12. So then he went, he told Mordecai what Esther had said, verse 13. And then Mordecai replied and told him to say this to Esther. Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. Verse 14. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance, it will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Now watch what he says at the end. This is so big, guys. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Mordecai, still sitting out there, he's wailing. Ah, you know. Dude shows back up, says, Esther says, not going to do it. He stops for a moment, collects himself. He says, you go tell her this. Don't believe for a minute they won't sniff you out. You think your security's in that palace? Oh, they'll find out about you. And they'll take care of you too. And the other thing he said to her was this. Is that as you're sitting in this palace, you think that's secure, you think that's the deal, is your life can be taken. And not only that, is that God will protect his people some way or another. But then he finally looked at her and he said, but you need to consider something. You need to ask yourself a different question. Could it be that God orchestrated bringing you to this point in the palace, the queen of Persia, for such a moment or such a time as this? You see, Esther was just like you, just like me, that when she was writing her story, she was building her story for security and meaning and purpose, that she got rocked to sleep spiritually into believing that her security was founded and based upon those things. What Mordecai, her great older cousin, reminded her of is no. Your only true security is in God. Your only true security is found in the one who made you, who is sovereign, who is all-powerful, who is over all things. He's the only one. And then he told her, and he said, here's the other thing you need to ask yourself. Quit asking the question of what will it cost you. Ask this question. Has God put me here for this? Am I to do this because God's put me here? That was the question he posed to Esther. Look at what Esther does. Verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai. She probably thought about it for a little while, right? Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. And do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my young women will also fast as you do. And then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. After she heard what Mordecai had to say, after she thought about it, her heart was awakened. She was reminded of the true reality that only in God is her true security, in Yahweh. And as a result of that, she had to think through and probably question and even ask God. Maybe she had not even thought of asking God to this point. Am I here for such a moment as this, God? And after receiving that answer, she sent word back to Mordecai and said, look, here's what you need to do. Get every Jewish person you know in Susa, in the capital, and pray and fast for me because I'm going to need it. I'm scared to death. And she said, I'm going to pray and I'm going to fast for 3 days. And at the end of these 3 days, I'm going to walk into that court and I'm going to stand before the king and I'm going to have my knees shaking and my legs shaking and with just fear all through me, I'm going to stand there. And if I perish, I perish. And what was so awesome, if you read the rest of the story, is 3 days later, Esther goes and she stands out there and the king sees her. And as she stood there, no doubt, fearful and scared to death, this could be it. He took his scepter and he tipped it toward her. She came forward. She said, hey, I want to invite you to a festival and bring Haman with you. Haman was the wicked dude. And then she invited him to another festival, a little party for them. And in that second party, she told him, she said, Haman is wicked. And he's having all the Jewish people slaughtered, including me. I'm one of them. And after revealing this information to Xerxes, Xerxes is enraged. And as fate would have it, or as God would have it, Haman, the wicked one, who drew up this grand scheme out of his own flippant ego, was hung on the gallows. And all the Jewish people, the law was changed that allowed Jewish people to be able to go out and to take care of themselves, to protect themselves. And so when that day came, the Jewish people won. And Esther, because of her courage, and Esther, because of saying, I will risk it all, is now in the Bible, thousands of years later, and celebrated for everything she had done. She got it wrong. Mordecai challenged her view of security. She asked a different question and ended up being used by God in an amazing way. Now, guys, here's how this applies to us today. Is that your life right now is intersecting certain circumstances, situations, and people that internally you're struggling with getting involved, helping, giving, serving, sacrificing, because you are living based on a lie that your security is found in the American dream, your security is found in that. I want to remind you this morning, just like Mordecai did to Esther, it's not true. God alone is your security. Now, is this a daily battle for all of us? Yes. I don't get this right all the time either. But this is the truth. And not only that, but once you understand, once you're reminded of God is my ultimate security, the question that follows is not what is this going to cost me, but it's God, with what I keep pushing back on, with this situation in my story and in my life that I tend to just get frustrated by and go, it's going to cost me too much, it's going to take too much, that maybe, God, am I here for this moment? Have you maneuvered and worked and done, orchestrated things to where I'm in this position with what I have and my skill and my relationships and my money and my whatever to make an impact on someone else's life and in the world? That's what God has for you. There's a guy right now that you've probably heard about in the media by the name of Pastor Youssef. I'll put his picture on the screen for you. And Pastor Youssef is an Iranian pastor that I think in 2009 was arrested. He's 35 years of age. And he was primarily arrested because he was out and he was fighting against them having certain schools in his, or books, I'm sorry, in his kids' schools. But Pastor Youssef has been in prison. He led a 400-member house church. That's a big house, isn't it? Surely they had multi-services, I would hope. But he led a house church. But while in prison, Pastor Youssef has been sentenced to death. And he has been given on multiple occasions an opportunity to get out of it by denying Jesus. It's that simple. Just say that basically you don't believe in Jesus anymore and we'll set you free. And Pastor Youssef won't do it. And so here's a guy that is married. He has children at home. He's young. He has his whole life ahead of him. And he's in prison. Could have been released. And he won't do it by denying Jesus. And as I was reading a letter that was released just the other day that he wrote. Finally, he wrote a letter and they were able to publish it and we can read it. He made this one statement, and I love hearing his honesty. He said, "I need to remind my beloveds," and he's talking about all these people that care and pray for him, "that though my trial has been so long, and in the flesh I wish these days to end, yet I have surrendered myself to God's will. Yet, I have surrendered myself to God's will." You see, Pastor Youssef is in a position to where if he were to ask the question about his story, what will it cost me? It may cost him his life. It cost him his family for these years. And the way out is to say, I'm not going to let myself, if you will, be taken from anything. I'm not going to sacrifice. And he has an out to do that. But what he's choosing to do is in the midst of where he's at, he's asking a different question. Based on his surrender to God. Is God, am I here for such a moment as this? And you know what's so awesome? Across the globe today, this 35-year-old Iranian pastor I would have never heard of, you would have never heard of, is all over the TVs, all through the newspapers, all in the magazines, of speaking about his situation. He's here for such a moment as this. And guys, for you and your story, you're where you are for such a moment as this. There is something God wants to do in your life that your life and your story is intersecting. And I don't know what that is, and I don't know what it looks like, but you need to rest on God is your security and begin asking the question, is this my moment, God? And if I perish, I perish. You know what the motivator for this is? And I love it. The motivator is Jesus. Because years after Esther left her palace to risk her life for those that were in need, Jesus, the Son of God, was in the greatest palace in heaven. And he looked down at all these folks, all these people that he had created, and he knew we were in the greatest need and the greatest position of need ever. And Jesus chose to not just step out of heaven to risk his life. He stepped out of heaven and gave his life for all of us. So that we, who were sinners, and we, who are as good as dead, could then be made alive again through him and what he's done for us. And so as you look at your life, and as you look at whatever your circumstances and situations are, and you rest in the security of God, and as you ask, is this my moment? Is this what you have me here for, God? That ultimately the motivator that fuels you to do that is your Savior who loves you, and by the Spirit within you gives you the strength to do what he calls you he's leading you to do. Let me pray for us. Father, we love you. God, this is one of those discussions that is very, very hard to share, especially when I fail at this so often myself. But God, I pray for every one of our hearts in here that we would no longer be deceived into believing that our security is found in anything we can possess and get our arms around and our hands on, because those things can be taken in an instant. But God, our ultimate security is in you. And Father, I pray every one of us would begin asking the question right where we're at, am I here for such a moment as this? Father, I pray you would just absolutely open our hearts. We'd surrender to you and be used by you to make an impact on the world around us and ultimately to point people to Jesus. God, thank you for loving us. Thank you for all these moms again. I pray you give them a great, great rest of the day. It's in Jesus' name that I pray. Amen.